Veteran economic historian Harold James is the author of a large number of monographs on topics ranging from international monetary cooperation and finance to models of economic unification. His special interests lie in the interwar economy, the economic history of fascism, and the case of Germany in particular. He is thus ideally suited to address the problems of his most recent book, The End of Globalization, Lessons from the Great Depression. Harold, welcome to Talking History.
It's great to be with you here.
Let's start in the 1920s. You argue that governments began the interwar period with the best of intentions to create an international economic order. What new policies and institutions did they create?
There was an enormous interest after the First World War in designing a system that would stop war recurring again. And people then, as indeed after the Second World War and now, recognize that dealing with peace, making peace, it requires a whole panoply of institutions. The most famous institution created in 1919 at the peace conference in Paris was the League of Nations. And the League of Nations is best known, I think, to scholars and historians of international relations as having a security dimension. But it also provided a lot of economic assistance. It had a so-called economic and financial section that was designed to stabilize countries, bring something like a market economy, and really in many ways functioned much as the International Monetary Fund did after the Second World War. So the League and its economic section is, I think, the most important of these institutions. The second one, which also began in 1919 and it still exists, is the International Labour Organization, which was originally given a quite extensive mandate in terms of trying to prevent unfair competition, competition by countries with very low wage levels or unsafe labor practices. That was a very ambitious agenda, and not a great deal of it was realized, and indeed not a great deal of it still is realized.
You write on page 25, "Rarely has there been so much enthusiasm for internationalism and international institutions as in the 1920s. And yet you add on the following page, in the 1930s, the world descended into economic nationalism and protectionism. So what changed?"
There are two things, I think, that changed quite dramatically. One is just an effect of having these international institutions. They create expectations about what they can do, and they distract in a way from national politics. And then gradually a disillusion sets in. Let me give you an example of the way that kind of thing works. It's common in the 1920s after the First World War, and it's still common today, that governments find it very, very difficult, particularly in times of great instability, to balance their budgets. And so they don't like to say we're putting up taxes or we're decreasing expenditures, but they like to say we're doing this because we absolutely have no choice and some international institution is telling us to do that. And that's exactly what, for instance, in the 1920s, the League did in the cases of Austria and Hungary. It went in and gave advice and told the Austrians and Hungarians to lay off tens of thousands of civil servants, to put up taxes and so on. So the Austrian and Hungarian government said, this is not really what we want, but this is what the League wants. But the result of that was that other countries said, if this is what the League does, we don't really want to deal with the League. And so there was a feeling of disenchantment by the end of the 1920s. That's one part of the story. The second part of the story, which I think is better known, is the story of the disenchantment of the United States with this whole international order, that President Wilson didn't negotiate in the best of ways in the Paris Peace Conference, and he was already quite weakened. His health was undermined by the conference. He had a series of strokes, and when he came back, he was unable to sell the idea of the League and the Covenant, which went with it, to the American Congress. So the United States was never fully engaged. And then in the course of the 1920s, the United States does things which provoke retaliation, particularly in the area of tariffs.
Right. In your book, you underplay the significance of the 1929 stock market crash, and you distinguish between a depression in production and a Great Depression. Could you elaborate on this?
Sure. I think we've seen lots of stock market crashes. You can probably tell from my accent that I'm originally from Britain. I came to the United States just in the late 80s when the stock market was going wild, and then it crashed in October 1987. But 87 didn't produce a sustained depression of any kind, so you can get stock market crashes without really bad setbacks in production. And indeed, there's been a dramatic stock market decline over the last 2.5 or so years. But there hasn't really been very much of the recession. The recession, if there is one, which I think there probably is very mild. And this is really quite common, that we have stock market crashes, stock market turbulence. We have recessions rather than deep depressions. In the 19th century, there were quite regular business downturns. But they didn't destroy the whole economic system in the way that the late 1920s and the early 1930s did. So something, I think, unique happened then.
What was that unique shift that created a Great Depression then?
It was the combination of the collapse of the trade regime with spiraling protective tariffs, quota regimes, non-tariff discrimination, and also a financial contagion of a kind that the world hasn't seen in the post-1945 world.
Right. You argued that the slide from a depression in production to a Great Depression was the result of this kind of dynamic and dangerous interplay between money, trade, and migration. Could you describe how this model works?
Sure. One of the things that occurs in the course of the First World War is that people get more worried about foreigners moving in and out for basically security reasons or nationalistic reasons. Before the First World War, as an example, there were lots and lots of waiters from Germany who worked in London restaurants. And in the war and afterwards, people think that's not such a good idea to have these Germans working in London restaurants because they might pick up politically sensitive information. So there was a great deal of restriction of migration. That actually removed one of the great motors of the international economy before the First World War, because the United States, for instance, had expanded as waves of migrants came in and got jobs and then got more prosperous and built houses. So the construction industry was closely linked to the cycle of inward migration into the United States. You can still imagine something happening without migration, though. Supposing the people who didn't move stay in their country, say they stay in Poland or Italy or Greece, and they make goods that they sell to the United States, that's fine as well. Then you've got some kind of activity, you've got things that cross frontiers. So goods crossing frontiers can really be a substitute for people moving. Now, in the course of the 1920s, what happened is that it got harder and harder to sell those goods, because countries like the United States and other countries then following the United States applied protective tariffs. So the Greek or the Pole or the Italian who couldn't migrate as a result of the restrictive immigration regime couldn't produce either, because there was no demand for the potential products of his or her labor.
Right.
And the financial flows are linked to this, because finance was part of the business of trying to get industries to develop.
Right. So much of your argument seems to focus on this problem of contagion, how in the context of globalization, a malaise in one country's political economy is actually transmitted to other countries. So, for instance, how and why were bank failures contagious?
There are really at least two reasons why contagion works very, very badly in the financial system. One is that supposing a lending bank in Britain or the United States has a loss in one area, its own creditors get nervous, and so they demand the repayment of credits, and then Britain and the United States are going to have to withdraw credits from other countries, apart from the one that's had problems, and withdrawing credits itself will produce problems. So that's one effect of contagion. The other effect is that people look around when they see a bad banking problem and try and identify countries that are similar to the country that's having the problem. So if Austria has a problem, you look around and see that Hungary and Italy and Germany are next door to Austria, and they have a similar institutional history, so people get nervous about their institutions.
So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. if you will. Once people start looking around and seeing what other countries are doing, they almost instigate the same problems for their own country.
That's right. So there was a lot of emphasis in the interwar period on maintaining confidence, and confidence was a kind of abstract, rather illusory thing that politicians and financiers were looking at restabilizing. But once confidence is gone, then the markets get very nervous and they start to do speculative attacks all over the place.
And another key factor in your book was the gold standard, that it also affected the spread of economic crisis in the 1930s. What went wrong with this international institution?
Well, the gold standard is a variant of a fixed currency regime. We have some countries in the world that still try to operate fixed currency regimes, and it has many attractions. It's a way of stabilizing prices. And that's primarily why it was so widely adopted in the 1920s as a result of trying to react to the First World War and its legacy. But the downside of the gold standard is that it creates a sort of possibility of one-way financial bets that speculators move into a country. They see an attractive interest rate differential, and then at some point they begin to see that the country can't maintain its payments for very long, and then they all flood out. So the effect of the gold standard in the late 20s and early 30s was actually to make the speculative flows worse, as indeed, for instance, in 1997 and 1998 in Asia, fixed currency regimes made the financial crisis there a lot worse.
Right. Let's turn to trade policies. How did the contagion of autarky spread through the international marketplace in the case of trade?
That, I think, is simpler to explain than the interconnection to the monetary system. Very much of what's going on is simple retaliation, that when the United States has the Fordney-McCumber tariff in 1922 or Smoot-Hawley in 1930, other countries feel that their products are being discriminated against, and so they institute policies, tariffs, that are designed to be applied against American products. Many European countries, for instance, after 1930, after Smoot-Hawley, banned specifically the import of American automobiles or American typewriters. So a large part of the spread is about simply imitating tariffs. There is another reason, though, that the tariff protection spreads, which is to do with countries trying to think of a way of stopping monetary deflation in one place spreading to another. And if you can't do anything on the monetary front because you're linked to the gold standard, changing the tariff level is a kind of second best option, which again looked attractive to many, many countries and policymakers.
The last case, the last aspect of your story is migration policy. And in that case, the story seems to be the inverse. You seem to suggest that there was an almost inevitable failure on the part of governments to create a viable international mechanism to regulate the labor market.
Yes. I think all these areas of internationalization or globalization, if you like, are controlled in quite different ways. That immigration policy of all the areas of the policy that we've talked about is the most vulnerable to populist initiatives. And there's a lot of kind of reactive nationalism and populism in the 1920s. In the restriction and exclusion of various categories of immigrants.
Right. Of course, the ultimate goal of your book was to draw lessons about the 1930s, about what you call the Seattle scenario. I really find that to be a very interesting title for it also. That is the this hypothetical circumstance in which the process of globalization might break down. You suggest in your book that there are various theories that are popular today for the reversal of globalization. Could you describe a few?
Sure. The nightmare scenarios, I think, are concerned firstly with contagious financial crises, and that's something that's loomed as a kind of spectacle of horror right through the story of the post-1945 world, the world after the Second World War, and the world where the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, operate. There have been a number of occasions in the late 60s, the early 1970s, with the breakdown of the fixed exchange rate regime then, the early 1980s with the Latin American debt crisis, 1997-1998 in Asia, where many people feared the possibility of a contagion like that of the interwar period. And in part, it's the historical memory that helped policymakers to have better policies and not to do what they did in the 1930s. So, in a sense, being aware of the historical problems, I think, has been really quite helpful in this area. And another area that I can think of where globalization can go wrong is what happens when trade liberalization goes into reverse. And I think that's one of those areas where it's difficult to imagine an absolutely stationary situation. The world after 1945 has worked basically through progressive rounds of liberalization. But if that would halt, it's difficult to see it just halting. I think it would go backwards, and people would then experiment with new tariff regimes, new monetary regimes, and you would get a breaking up into great blocks. It's periodically, again, come up as a possibility, but it would be something that would make us very much less well off if we were to go on that route.
And what does your research suggest to you about the future of globalization? Do you see it proceeding apace or reversing?
In the long run, I think the story of history is really quite clear that globalization goes in waves that do come to an end at some point. And that was in large part the message of my book, that we've had a number of these cycles of globalization, not just the very well-known one of the late 19th century, the early 20th century, which ended with the First World War and the Great Depression, but also the 18th century was a bit like this. The late 15th, the early 16th century was a period of tremendous integration, which then fell apart. And they fall apart largely because of the resentments that build up. People complain about the way that wealth is being redistributed, that some fortunes are being made illegitimately, that there are tales of corruption, corporate scandals. And to me, the current period really has a bit of that feeling of the years before the First World War, when corporate scandal, corporate corruption was very much in the minds of people and being discussed. The 18th century, you know, if you think back to the circumstances in which the United States was created, it was created in part as a protest against big corporations like the East India Company. It was the tea of the East India Company that the protesters dumped in Boston Harbor. So, you know, the United States actually owes its origins in part to an anti-globalization protest.
Very interesting. Thank you very much. My guest today has been veteran economic historian Harold James. His most recent study, The End of Globalization, was published by Harvard University Press in 2001. His book was completed before 9/11, before the SARS epidemic, but he seems unfortunately prophetic when he drew the following conclusion about societies that have been marginalized by the process of globalization. On page 217, he writes, "If these societies cannot export goods and participate in international society, they will not remain simply self-contained in a ghetto of misery and inhumanity. They will export their problems, their terrorism, their violence, and even their diseases." ¶¶